I'm Sam Freeman, and this is Practicing. In the clinical work I do in urgent care pediatrics, most of the kids I see come in with an injury or an infection, a fever, a cough, a runny nose, GI symptoms. That means that, as is the case for many, if not most, pediatricians, so much of what I do revolves around diagnosing infections and counseling families about them. It's routine work, but it has its challenges. The most difficult thing, I think, is seeing parents who are desperate for relief, exhausted from sleepless nights with a sick, crying child, and having to tell them that their child isn't in danger, that nothing more needs to be done, and that this too shall pass on its own. That disconnect between the distress parents feel, and which I too have felt as a parent, and the routine nature of these illnesses is tricky to navigate. In the last few months, and in particular this past fall, it seems as if all of society and much of the news cycle in Canada and the US turned its attention to childhood infections. With an extraordinary wave of RSV and then influenza, pediatric emergency rooms and hospitals were overwhelmed with sick patients. Coming in the midst of the COVID pandemic, this wave of viral infections had health systems reeling. In Canada, shortages of medications like common antibiotics and pediatric formulations of ibuprofen and acetaminophen compounded the sense of chaos and of a breakdown in health services. All that has now passed, but I wanted to revisit those events and talk a little bit about what happened. My next guest is someone I've come to trust on this subject for his abilities as a communicator. Alistair Munro is a senior clinical research fellow in pediatric infectious diseases at the UK National Institute for Health and Care Research in Southampton, England, and a medical doctor. He's currently a senior trainee in pediatrics, working in pediatric emergency medicine. During the pandemic, he led the live evidence review of COVID-19 in children with the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health in the UK, while running a number of different COVID-19 vaccine clinical trials. He also sat on the Lancet Commission on COVID-19, as well as the NIHR Working Group for the Study of Transmission of COVID in Schools. Alistair's gained a large Twitter following, and his Substack newsletter, The Munro Report, is widely shared. Whenever I read Alistair, I feel he captures the way I and most pediatricians I know think about COVID, about other infections, and about pediatrics more broadly. We cover all of that in our conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Although I never provide medical advice on this show, since this episode is about my area of clinical expertise, I wanted to make it extra clear that nothing in the following discussion should be construed as direct medical advice to you or a child you know. For those questions, you should see a healthcare provider. And now, here's my conversation with Alistair Munro. Alistair Munro, welcome to Practicing.
Thank you so much for having me today, Sam. Nice to meet you, meet you at last.
I'm delighted to have you on. Alistair, we're now 3 years into the COVID pandemic. What do we know about COVID and children?
Oh, well, we know a lot, I guess.
So maybe to help make that a little more specific, if you had to summarize in 3 to 5 bullet points the kind of takeaway that you have on this vast topic, what would it be?
The main things would be that COVID as a sort of as a clinical disease in children carries a burden similar to that of other common respiratory viruses in kids. It's sort of in the same ballpark. What that mainly means is that for children who are sort of otherwise healthy, it is predominantly really a very mild illness, often asymptomatic and otherwise often just causes sort of cold-like symptoms. But it can be more dangerous for children who have particularly significant comorbidities like severe neurodisability, or children, you know, with life-limiting conditions who are already, you know, very vulnerable to respiratory viral infections. The caveat to that was the hyperinflammatory syndrome known as MIS-C, or in England it's known as PIMS-TS, which was sort of a delayed onset overactive immune response to COVID that can cause sort of profound organ dysfunction and can be life-threatening, and, you know, occurs in healthy children or whoever, really, at the same kind of rates.
In a way that that resembled a kind of already known condition in pediatrics before COVID.
Yeah, that's right. So looked a lot like Kawasaki disease, but with a sort of more profound, you know, cardiogenic shock elements. So as kids with Kawasaki's always look very sad and can develop severe complications, they weren't usually very sort of hemodynamically unstable, which was sort of the big difference with MIS-C. But the really great thing about MIS-C, there's not many great things about it, but the great thing is that it seems to be disappearing more or less. Rates were much higher per infection early in the pandemic. And not only have rates per infection dropped, but they've dropped so much that even the total rates have dropped, even though infections are many, many, many times more common than they used to be. And it's become almost vanishingly rare, which is excellent. And no one's quite sure why that is, although it's probably a combination of both changes in the virus making it less likely to trigger that hyperactive immune response, but also it looks like pre-existing immunity, either through vaccination or previous infection, makes developing the condition much less common. So those are probably the two most important things about clinical illness. And then I guess the really big thing has always been transmission, because it was recognized so early on that kids had such mild disease that people weren't too concerned about that, but that almost led to more concern over transmission, because if you have high rates of asymptomatic illnesses, lots of transmission going on unnoticed, and then what are the implications for that on policy, like school closures and that kind of stuff. And certainly rates of asymptomatic disease are much higher in children, probably in the region of 50%, depending on the time you studied it and the variant, but that's, you know, a rough ballpark figure. And then transmission's been really interesting because it hasn't really turned out to look much like what we expected at the beginning. So whilst people were imagining, you know, what we normally see with respiratory viruses, that younger children, who they develop more symptoms, they spread it more readily for things like flu, they tend to have a disproportionate amount of transmission. Actually, for COVID, it looks like that was sort of the inverse, and actually younger children were probably the least ready transmitters of any age group. They seem to generally have lower viral loads, lower rates of secondary transmission outside of the household, and certainly through population prevalence testing that we did in the UK, where you just test loads of households at almost at random and seeing how many people are infected. Much lower rates of illness in children under the age of 12 than young adults or teenagers, which is not what you'd expect, because they were all in school for most of the time, having, you know, four or five times the rates of contacts of adults. And that's changed as the sort of the pandemic's progressed due to changes in population immunity. So we obviously had this stage where we suddenly vaccinated all the adults very quickly over the space of sort of 6 months or so, and then, you know, up to three doses within the space of a year. And then we had the Omicron wave where younger children had very little immunity at all, you know, only less than half of them had ever been infected and none of them had been vaccinated. And so when we had this big wave of infection with Omicron, we saw much higher rates of transmission from younger children and higher rates of disease. And then that's changed again over the course of the last year since Omicron's come about, because those really high rates of infection in younger children seem to have conferred really high rates of immunity against Omicron. And since then, they've had the lowest prevalence of disease again, almost the whole time. So there's been this really interesting shift in transmission burden. But when all other things were sort of held equal at the start of the pandemic, yeah, surprisingly little transmission from younger children, which was the sort of opposite of what we expected.
And I guess that leads into my next question, which is that on balance, in things you've written in your newsletter and in some opinion articles and in medical journals, you've been skeptical of the benefits of masking younger children under the age of 5. And as I read it, even more skeptical of long-term school closures. I'm assuming that's connected to what you just discussed, but can you flesh that out a little bit more as to why you have those positions?
These are pretty generic positions really over here in the UK and in Europe, certainly, and in Australia too. I think as a general rule for kids sort of under the age of five, it's generally accepted that adherence to masking is not optimal, that because the benefits are relatively marginal most of the time, you know, for non-medical grade masks, it's not really worth forcing them to do it for the minimum amount of benefit they would get, and given that they're low risk of illness. And, you know, there's not really great evidence that it's very effective in that age group. There's some studies that suggest it has really no clinically meaningful benefit. And so, you know, the World Health Organization and health authorities within Europe generally say don't mask kids under the age of five. You know, there's a bit of heterogeneity then between the ages of sort of 5 and 12 in the UK. And in Northern Europe, kids under the age of 12 have never been asked to mask. But in other parts of Western Europe, they have masked those age groups. And then generally, once you're over the age of 12, you can mask and it's not much hassle to you. And then for school closures, really, it's been an issue of trade-offs, I guess. What's particularly difficult about that as a trade-off for children is because the clinical burden of disease is pretty low in kids, they don't gain a huge amount from school closures through the prevention of transmission. And the reason we say that is because there was already lots of transmission of respiratory viruses in school-aged children before with a risk profile that wasn't very different from COVID. And we would never really have considered closing schools in that kind of context. And the reason we didn't is because we know that school closures come with a large amount of associated harms themselves, and particularly for vulnerable children. And this is harms on, you know, a range of things. So there's obviously the concerns about academic achievement and the differential impacts of that on, you know, disadvantaged communities, and how that lost learning, you know, impacts sort of lifelong achievement and attainment and earnings. And then beyond that, we know that, you know, children are inherently social. It's sort of a pretty key part of their development, and then preventing them from seeing their peers for prolonged periods of time, particularly for adolescents, has some potential, you know, significant impacts for them and their mental health. And then there's a whole host of other health benefits that schools provide, you know, for safeguarding. It's often the only hot meal a lot of disadvantaged children will get during the day. And then in terms of accessing things like mental health services or other, you know, routine screening things, schools are often a key place for that stuff to be undertaken. And so closing them for any longer than a very brief period is potentially having very big impacts, because all children are in school. So when schools are closed, you're impacting your whole population of school children. So even small, you know, impacts at an individual level become very big impacts at a population level. It's been a pretty key priority in a lot of places to try and keep schools open. Certainly after the first lockdown in the UK, the motto was that schools should very much be the last places to close and the first places to open. And a lot of countries did pretty well.
And I guess the last piece to that is this idea that schools were driving transmission, probably because of what you said about how kids were not that relatively responsible for the transmission of COVID, didn't really add a lot of rationale to closing schools.
Yeah. And I think in particular, you know, younger children, which were the ones that I think people were most concerned about, had, you know, much lower rates of transmission than expected. Adolescents, probably lower rates than you would anticipate, given the rates of contacts, but still, you know, relatively high prevalence, not as high as in young adults. And so just in terms of where you prioritize your non-pharmaceutical interventions for transmission, what you might predict you would gain from school closures based on our mental models of children being responsible for propagating epidemic waves, that wasn't really the case early on for COVID. It was much more young adults. And so when you get into situations where you've got bars and restaurants open, but schools closed, it's completely upside down, both in terms of where probably the burden of transmission is really happening, and then also the priorities for how much harm comes from closing bars and restaurants. Economic harm, certainly, but the state can borrow money to reimburse those kind of economic harms. But then if you close schools, you can't undo those harms. Those are social health and educational attainment harms that are very, very difficult to undo. So yeah, I think that's why that recognition of the young adults being more important for disease transmission than younger children especially was important to recognise.
So let's take all that to be true. I'm convinced that it is. As you say, I don't think what you're saying is very controversial. But some people do think so. And those people would argue that it's a mistake to focus only on transmission of the acute infection or even on the relatively mild clinical consequences of the acute infection. Because what is also concerning are the delayed and prolonged effects of even mild infection. And I'm talking about long COVID and the prolonged disability that might result from long COVID. What do we know about those risks for kids?
Well, I think it's been very difficult to study because of a lack of really good definitions in the first instance. If you look at the studies that try and actually assess, you know, prevalence, they will be so vague as to be almost not meaningful, particularly since early on, you know, a lot of studies are done from quite the early pandemic periods of 2020, 2021. If you break down, you know, what symptoms are persisting in children at that time, a lot of it is just anosmia or agresia, so loss of smell or taste. And those are disabling symptoms, like those are important symptoms, but that's not usually what people are talking about when they're thinking of long-term disability or dangerous long-term effects in children. What people are normally talking about is, you know, a syndrome resembling a chronic fatigue type syndrome with prolonged fatigue and breathlessness and brain fog and this kind of thing. Trying to dig deeper into, you know, the relative incidence of those symptoms in children, it does appear to be really quite uncommon, actually. And this is reflected in things like we have a long COVID service, a long COVID clinic that serves the region. And the rates of referral to that are not very high. This is not to dismiss the burden that this has on the children who are affected. You know, it can be really disabling for them and difficult for the family. But fortunately, it doesn't appear to be a very common sequelae. You know, most kids will suffer a very mild illness, and that will be the end of it. The higher quality studies that exist that have control groups to compare, you know, the rates of persistent symptoms against groups of children who have had COVID, there is usually not very much difference. It does appear to increase during adolescence. And I think that we know that age as well as disease severity both tend to be risk factors for having more persistent symptoms. Unfortunately, younger children are sort of the lowest risk for both of those things. So it's not occurring at huge rates. It may be, you know, in the order of 1-2% of children. And this is probably not that dissimilar from what we would see from a lot of other respiratory viral infections. What we do know from clinics that we have running that are supporting children with long COVID is that the prognosis has been really good. So the vast majority of children seem to recover really quickly and, you know, are able to sort of be discharged with really good function from the service. So it's been reassuring to hear that feedback from the people who are running these clinics.
So I want to turn to what just happened in the fall of 2022 and the early winter of 2023, which really saw a very big surge of respiratory disease in children, probably the worst since the start of the pandemic. Certainly in the case of the Northern Hemisphere, particularly here in Canada and the US and in Europe. Honestly, I don't know as much about Eastern Europe or Asia or the Southern Hemisphere and whether those patterns were reproduced. Maybe you do. But in any case, in these areas, systems were strained, in particular because there were simultaneous peaks of RSV, influenza, streptococcal infections, particularly in the UK, and other viruses as well that we don't always diagnose specifically, but we know are out there. Ironically, COVID didn't really seem to play much of a role in that wave, although there was concern about it at the time. Tell us a little bit more about what happened there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And it has been quite different, actually, I think, in a lot of places. I know it looks like in Canada it was really bad, particularly with flu and RSV, and in different parts of the US as well. And we were expecting that in the UK. And what we got actually was a pretty average RSV wave, but off the back of sort of grumbling unusually high rates of RSV over the sort of past year prior to that. And so we had a summer wave in 2021 that was not had a big peak, but was really long, really long tail. And then we had another bump in the summer of 2022 and thought, oh, here comes the next summer wave. It sort of ebbed out. And then we got a winter wave that looked almost like normal. And that coincided with a wave of flu, which we really felt it was a slightly worse than average year of flu, but not quite so crippling. What really hammered us was not even actually rates of group A strep, but the anxiety around group A strep really, really hammered us. I mean, there were unusually a large number of cases, in particular of group A strep empyema. I think at one point we had a whole bay full of children with chest drains with group A strep empyema, which is something we've never really seen before.
A lung abscess, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, this is unusual for group A strep, but not coming in the numbers to really strain the system. But down in the emergency department, because it was all over the news, we were absolutely overrun. We were seeing more than double our usual winter numbers of presentations. And a lot of that was driven by the rates of group A strep anxiety, because we weren't actually admitting many more children than we normally would. But it has been interesting how different it's been in different places. But the sort of the disruption of these normally quite predictable viruses and this sort of this ecosystem that has previously existed, where we get these predictable patterns of transmission and these waves of infection that occur more or less the same time of year most years, and within a range, a fairly predictable amount of disease. And a lot of that stuff's gone completely out of the window. So seeing these summer waves of infection, seeing an early winter wave of group A strep in the UK, where that would normally be coming in the spring, we've got norovirus coming now, you know, months earlier than it would normally come. A lot of this disruption is thought to have been caused by very long periods of having almost no disease at all. So, of course, these measures that were introduced during the pandemic to prevent transmission of COVID don't just interrupt COVID, they interrupt almost all communicable diseases. And we saw, you know, flu almost completely vanished. We had a whole season with no RSV at all. And what that means is where these infection waves are largely influenced by how much immunity there is in the population. If you go an extra year with not gaining any more immunity, but that immunity continuing to wane with time, because we know that your antibody levels and stuff fall away with time, when people do start mixing again and you take away those measures that have prevented transmission, you're going to expect more transmission than usual, and it's going to happen at weird times. And that's really what we've been seeing, is these strange patterns of transmission occurring, because, you know, kids and adults as well have lower rates of immunity than they would have had normally. And, you know, and in the pediatric population, there'll be more children who have never been exposed to RSV or group A strep than might usually. You know, we normally expect to see these outbreaks of scarlet fever and stuff in very young school-aged children who are encountering it for the first time, and it takes multiple exposures to build up immunity. And now we've got, you know, probably a couple of year groups who had just never experienced it before, and suddenly when it comes back, all of them are catching it for the first time. So I think that's what is thought to be influencing these weird patterns of infection. And then, you know, if you're unlucky enough to get really big waves of a couple of them at the same time, that's such bad news for health systems that are not set up to deal with unusually high burdens of illness.
In the wake of this unusual surge in infections, all sorts of theories emerged. And I would say online, but honestly, they spilled over into mainstream media, definitely here. Some very high-profile health columnists in the mainstream media picked up on some of these theories. One of them was that a previous COVID infection, namely the Omicron wave of early 2022 that affected so many people, was causing a sort of immune deficiency that was leading to other viral infections. And then on the kind of other side of that, there was this much bandied about, but to my knowledge, rarely if ever expressed by anyone legitimate, erroneous notion of immunity debt that said that not having been infected by viruses because of pandemic measures had made children's immune systems lazy or ineffective. And I would just contrast that to the actual concept of immunity debt, which is sort of what you described before, a collective populational concept, which means that if a virus doesn't infect a population for a period of time, the overall rate of immunity, readiness to combat that virus might be lower, even though everyone's individual immune system works just fine. So tell us a little about those two theories, if there's any scientific basis for either, and what you think happened there.
Yeah, okay. So talking about the first one, so this idea that COVID infection somehow causes immune deficiency, it comes from, I guess, this recognition we do have that for a lot of viral infections, including respiratory viruses, what you will often get, because the way that viruses have adapted is that they have mechanisms to evade immunity and to try and, you know, make it harder for your immune system to kill them, they will often cause your immune system to go a bit haywire whilst you're infected. And there's a brief period after infection where your immune system, you know, may be recovering from having had the virus on board. And so we do see this phenomenon of bacterial co-infection or super-infection, where you've been made more prone to, you know, say getting a bacterial pneumonia or whatever because you had a virus for a very brief period. And actually, as a matter of fact, we think that's one of the reasons why there's been much higher rates of group A strep empyema in the UK, because we had group A strep come at the same time as flu and RSV and other viruses that it wouldn't normally circulate with. And we have found really high rates of respiratory virus co-infection in these cases. Interestingly, not COVID, make of that what you will. But I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why people thought that this could be something that happens with COVID. But it's sort of gone this step further, and it's looking at infections that happened months prior to, you know, these big surges in RSV or flu, and then saying, well, is this because COVID has somehow knackered kids' immune systems? And there really is no evidence for that at all. Pretty much everything that we've seen has just been higher numbers of what is normal in children, and which is sort of quite readily explained by this idea that there's just less population immunity because there's been this long period where there were lower rates of infection than usual. And now that mixing is happening again at higher rates, we're just seeing more infection. It's like a catch-up of infections that would have occurred over that same time period normally, but are happening within a shorter space of time. All of the evidence from what we're seeing in kids clinically and in the lab studies doesn't show any evidence of any clinically relevant immune dysregulation in kids. Their immune system seemed to be working just fine. And then I guess this other, you know, weird misinterpretation of immunity debt, I think, is based off the kind of the hygiene hypothesis, which was this theory about early childhood exposure to friendly bacteria or commensal bacteria, the kind of bugs that normally live in your skin and your gut, is really important for training your immune system what to respond to and what not to respond to. And that if there's not enough exposure to healthy bacteria, that you might be at high risk of developing allergies. And this is, you know, still something that's thought to be perhaps at play. But that's then getting confused with thinking that if your immune system is not being exposed to pathogens, infectious pathogens, enough, that it would somehow be weaker. There's just no scientific basis for that at all. The immune system is very complicated, and so there are some sort of niche concepts about exposure to live pathogens like viruses or bacteria. So things like, if you give kids BCG vaccines in Western Africa, you find lower rates of mortality from lots of infections, not just tuberculosis. And it's the same for other live vaccines, but not from non-live vaccines. So we do know that there's something about live pathogens that may have generic impacts on the immunity and improving the immune system, but not to any relevant basis when we're talking about normal respiratory pathogens like flu and RSV and that kind of thing. There is absolutely no reason to believe that not being exposed to those has clinically relevant detrimental impacts on your immune system. And in fact, we know that exposure to RSV, whilst it does give you immunity to RSV, it's not necessarily good for your immune system in general because of these funny things that, you know, viruses do to try and evade your immune system. We know that RSV, for example, can lead to higher rates of wheezing later on in life and potentially can impact development of asthma because of how it triggers the immune system and that sort of stuff. So no, there's no evidence that COVID is causing immune deficiency, and there's no evidence that children's immune systems have generally been negatively impacted by not being exposed to nasty infections for a couple of years.
So the culprit then is, I think, our information ecosystem.
What's been interesting is that I know you say that it somehow made its way into the mainstream media in Canada, but it's interesting that it's not in most other places. It's, you know, it's funny how you get these sort of regional pockets of different things sort of coming to the fore. I wouldn't have been aware of it if it wasn't for the internet, for example. You know, it's not something that's come up in the media or in general conversation here.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's where the people in the media get these notions. And you've written about this in your newsletter about how bad science gets spread. What are your thoughts on how scientific knowledge is communicated and disseminated?
I think social media has been a real game changer, hasn't it? I think we've really seen that during the pandemic. And part of that is because we've increased the speed that it's getting disseminated, and, you know, then the demand and the expectation for the speed that stuff should get disseminated has increased as well. You know, people want their news yesterday. You know, we're not willing to wait anymore, and you get rewarded for being the first to the post. You know, you being first is better than being best. What that means is that due diligence is not always done when vetting research, and certainly in the social media game is you've got to be first and you've got to drive engagement. And the way that you drive engagement is simple, extreme messages generally. And the problem is that these things are not really conducive to good science, because good science is rarely ever digestible in the space of 30 seconds, and nor is it suddenly really extreme and clickbaity. Most science, unfortunately, is, well, or fortunately, isn't like that, but that's what how you need to present it in order to drive engagement and be successful. And if you do that, you get rewarded for it, and so you do it more. And we see it from, you know, these famous accounts who, you know, use all their emojis and superlatives and all of that kind of stuff. And it does make it difficult, you know, because there will always be people who will digest that and who will look for it and will generally be looking for what confirms their pre-existing beliefs, because that's what is pleasant to consume. So if you think that COVID is, you know, a mass disabling event and is basically the apocalypse, you're going to look for people who are telling you that. And if you think COVID has always just been a cold or was basically made up or invented by the mainstream media, then you're going to be looking for people who are telling you that. And, you know, they'll be happy that you're clicking on them and you'll be happy that you're reading it. But it makes it very difficult for people who are just trying to look for unbiased, balanced information to try and educate themselves. And it makes it hard for public health authorities to try and compete for attention when they're not being able to produce that kind of material.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think it's actually so basic that it's just people don't want to read the same thing 2 days in a row. So there's this pressure to create a new take when there's like no new take. What's going on is this, and it's continuing to go on, and it will end. You know, like this wave is going to end. All the waves pass. They have a pattern, but you have all this like micro speculation and these new ideas. And then people who are generating content in different media also need new ideas to write about. So they pick them up sometimes without really checking. You've written about one of the great failures of the pandemic as you see it, which is the failure to generate high quality scientific evidence, particularly on non-pharmaceutical interventions like masking. Can you tell me a little more about that?
So, I mean, I'm a great believer in randomized controlled trials. You know, I've spent most of the pandemic running randomized controlled trials of vaccines, and we've seen how successful they've been. I think there's been a huge amount of controversy about non-pharmaceutical interventions, particularly because there is not great evidence about how effective many of them have been, you know, under different conditions, and then also about what harms were associated with them. And that's the information you really need in order to be able to make good decisions about what non-pharmaceutical interventions to use and when. You can forgive this stuff very early on in the pandemic when no one's quite sure what's about to happen, and there's a bit of a panic over the worst case scenario, and you just sort of need to do some stuff, wait and see what happens, and then try and muddle your way out of it. But, you know, we managed to do some trials. So I think one of the great successes of the pandemic was a randomized controlled trial of daily contact testing of school children for COVID versus blanket quarantine of contacts to see how it impacted transmission. And, you know, there really seemed to be no noticeable difference, really negligible difference between doing that. And that, what a great study that is, because you can keep kids in school by just doing daily tests rather than sending them all home for 2 weeks. People have tried to do studies of masks, but because of the different cultural responses to mask wearing, they've often been done in settings where it's been hard to really generalize the results to other settings. We don't have great studies of the benefits of community masking, you know. So, like, we know that, like, medical grade masks, if you put the mask on, it is going to filter particles. It's going to do what it's been tested to do. You know, they've got quality assurances. And if I am going in to see a patient in a cubicle, I know he's got COVID, and I put on a respirator mask, I know that I am extremely unlikely to acquire COVID via an inhaled route during that exposure. Right. I mean, because that is what the mask does. When you try and then use lower grade masks, you try and give them to people in communities that don't really know how to wear them, usually don't wear them right, and most importantly, are not wearing them during the periods at which they're most likely to catch COVID, which is at home with their family or at lunch breaks or out for coffee or whatever. You've got to have some idea of what effect does actually asking people to wear masks in that scenario have, because it's a burden on people to have to do it. They're not comfortable. It generates a huge amount of waste. We don't often talk about the environmental impact, but, man, you know, there's masks clogging up rivers and other stuff now that has to be thought about. And you've got to consider when is it worth doing this and when is it not. Arguably, you know, in a pre-vaccine era where the risk of disease is so much higher, even if you're getting only 10% reduction in cases, that's well worthwhile, because a 10% reduction in cases might reduce, you know, your number of deaths by 1% overall. And if you're going to get 1 million deaths and you reduce them by 1%, that's a lot of deaths you've stopped. And, you know, even those marginal differences can be worthwhile. But you've got to have an idea of roughly how much difference it makes. And you can do those trials. They are not easy to do and they're expensive. But look at what a mess we're in without the evidence. You know, people can't decide. You're having, in really politicized countries, you're having regions that are basically banning people from wearing them at all. And you've still got places that are legally mandating two-year-olds to wear masks. It's crazy. And, you know, there's not much for people to hang their hat on other than really poor quality observational studies that are, you know, are clearly heavily confounded, that you can choose to believe if you want, and you can just choose to completely ignore if you want. And it's really hard to argue against people either way, because they've made up their minds. It would have been less of an issue if a lot of the stuff hadn't become so politicized and polarized. A lot of this stuff has become heavily mixed with sort of identity politics and that kind of stuff in some places. But, you know, we've missed an opportunity, particularly once people were largely vaccinated and the risk of illness had decreased, but there was still an appetite for doing some NPIs. When people were lifting restrictions, that was an opportunity to say, well, look, we're slowly taking this stuff off. Let's just randomize it. Let's just randomize some communities to doing it now, and some will keep it a little bit longer, and we can see what happens. You know, we were testing everyone all the time at one point. And I think, unfortunately, the ship has sailed in a lot of places. The UK was probably the country most likely to do something like that. I think between us and Denmark have done pretty much all of the studies of this type so far. And I don't think there's any appetite in either country for doing it locally, because masks have just gone, you know, no one's really wearing them outside of hospitals at all anymore. And I don't know what it would take for people to want to consider doing it again. But it's a shame that the opportunity's been missed. We knew it would have been a good idea very early on. And I think that ship has largely sailed, sadly.
You know, people might say, so what? We're done with this thing, pretty much. However, it was a learning opportunity for the future. And I think that's the great shame. And I just, you know, want to put a little point on it, that the quality of the evidence really does matter. One of the things that I think happened with this pandemic is like everybody became a consumer of health news and science news. But a study is almost a meaningless term. A study can mean that you spoke to five people, or it can mean you systematically randomized a few hundred people and rigorously monitored all kinds of things and then did a statistical analysis to find out if those two groups were actually different. Those nuances make all the difference. I wanted to just step back to talk a little bit about pediatrics in general. It's what we both do clinically. And one of the things I really appreciate that you take time to write about and think about is the more common problems of pediatrics. Things like fever. What does it mean to have a fever? Why do we have fever? Why should it be scary or not scary? You've written about, you know, the challenge clinically of picking the needle out of the haystack when younger children have fever and we're worried about finding that rare, serious bacterial infection when the vast majority of kids with a fever have harmless viruses. A while back in this conversation, you said something about how in this wave of RSV that was depicted as a nightmare, as a tremendous hardship to the health system, which it was, you said it was normal. And I didn't even skip a beat because I knew what you meant. But I think that highlights the gulf between what we know as clinicians to be normal, which could mean a child that's having trouble breathing, a child that's had fever for 5 days, a child that won't eat a meal for a week because they're sick, and what parents and the public perceive as normal. I often find the deep challenge of the work we do is that most of what we see is routine. It's not dangerous. It's self-limiting illness. So often, essentially viral infections, but a small share of it will be hiding something more dangerous. How do you think about that? How do you approach it as a clinician, as someone who thinks more broadly about what we do?
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult thing to think about because you've got to hold two things in real tension. So one is that I think the much bigger problem for the population and for health services is is health literacy and parents understanding, you know, what is normal, because, you know, for better or worse, it is sadly normal for children to be unwell sometimes. There's no avoiding the fact that there's lots of viruses and bacteria around that are going to cause some infections, and the vast majority of those are self-limiting. They don't need any medical attention at all, and the child will feel unwell for a few days, but then they'll recover, and it's an unavoidable part of gaining immunity to what is, you know, the essential ecosystem of viruses and bacteria that circulate in humans. There is a real lack of understanding about what is normal and what are the things you should or should not worry about in kids. So we spend a huge amount of time in the emergency department educating parents and reassuring them about what's normal. In fact, that's what I spend most of my time doing, is talking to them about why things happen and why they're normal and when you should worry. But what's difficult is that although that's 95% of what we're seeing, there are those rare occasions that we really need to catch where the kids are really sick. And if we don't intervene early, could end up with lifelong morbidity or could even die. And early on, you cannot tell the difference between those kids and the kids with the benign, you know, viral upper respiratory tract infections or whatever. They look exactly the same. And so these days when kids get brought to medical attention very early, we're frequently seeing them at a time where you can't differentiate. And I think what happens is we put a lot of emphasis on trying to find those kids then. And I genuinely think we probably can't, actually. I don't think there's any tests that will ever be high fidelity enough to discriminate without, you know, causing huge numbers of false positives. And also because a lot of the kids, the first time you see them, don't yet have the thing that's going to make them really sick, because actually they probably do just have a virus, but they're going to get a bacterial super infection, you know, a Staph aureus bacteremia or a pneumococcal infection or something later, and they don't have it now. So you can't catch them. So I do think that trying to increase education of parents as to what to look out for helps them stay at home when they don't need to be coming to hospital, and hopefully makes them more likely to come to hospital when they do need to, and just make them aware that the situation changes and your child can be poorly but look normal for a poorly child now. You know, they don't need to come to hospital now, but they might need to later. You know, they might become more unwell, and trying to determine that illness trajectory is difficult. Sadly, we're victims of a really successful, mainly vaccination and public health campaign that's driven rates of stuff like, you know, the scourges of infancy, like measles, basically gone most places. Haemophilus influenza B, basically gone. Meningococcal disease, vanishingly rare. 5 years maybe before I started practicing, pediatric wards would be full of these kids all the time. And, you know, people would be seeing epiglottitis, meningitis, bacteremias with all this stuff on a daily basis. And now, you know, we'll have primary care doctors who may not see a case their whole career of a lot of this stuff. So, you know, it's great that it's so rare, but it makes it so hard to find practical ways of identifying those kids early. You know, once they're sick, it's obvious because they're sick. You can see they're sick and you can manage them. It's trying to catch them in that window before they've gotten really sick. But when they're a bit more sick than the majority of the other kids that we've found, I think it's a really difficult problem. And I think people find it hard to accept that we're never going to get it to zero. I don't think there's any way of doing that. We'll all have had experience of those really tragic cases where the kid looked fine until an hour before they didn't, and then it was too late. And that, you know, they can just deteriorate so quickly. I'm not sure there's ever any way of eliminating that possibility.
I think it's also interesting to think about how we have a tendency to normalize things in pediatrics, and we come by that honestly because it's what we have to do all the time. But it's the great Achilles heel of what we do as well, because when you get really used to normalizing things is when you might just normalize one thing too many. And that is a tension, I think you're right, that just we have to always live with and be very open to being wrong. Alistair, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about what we do and about all the research you've done and all your perspectives. It was really a treat. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Alistair Munro. For more information, check out the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show and rate it on the platform of your choice and spread the word. And if you have any comments or guest suggestions, please don't hesitate to reach out through the show's website, practicingpod.com. That's practicing with a C. I'll be back with more conversations on practicing, so stay tuned. Practicing is hosted, written, and produced by me, Sam Freeman. Sarah Freeman provides invaluable editorial advice. Artwork is by Jeff Landman. Music is by Mr. Smith, made available under Creative Commons licensing. Thanks also to Juniper Belshaw, Jeff Dyke, Katarina Haddad, Jess Malls, Howard Mitnick, Ezra Siller, and Catherine Tang.